From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Justice Department's Inspector General will release a highly anticipated report today addressing allegations that the FBI mishandled the investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email server. Critics on the left and the right have slammed former FBI Director James Comey for the way he oversaw the probe, and this new report is likely to give both sides something to crow about. NPR Justice Department correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
And the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, has been looking into the Clinton email investigation for 18 months now. What prompted him to do that and why?
Well, Horowitz announced this investigation in January of 2017, just a couple days before President Trump took office. And Horowitz said that he would look into the FBI and the Justice Department's actions surrounding the Clinton investigation, and said that he was doing this in response to requests that he got from both members of Congress as well as members of the public. Remember, the FBI's handling of the investigation had people on both sides, as you noted, really kind of up in arms after the 2016 vote. Republicans were saying that Comey went easy on Clinton, that a fix was in, she should have been charged. Democrats, on the other hand, were saying that Comey essentially cost Clinton the election by his actions over the course of 2016.
And who are the major players here? Who is the report focused on? Is it mainly Comey?
Well, the big name is, of course, James Comey. He's expected to be rebuked over his decision to go public in July of 2016 when he announced that the FBI was closing the Clinton investigation. He also said at that press conference that she was extremely careless in her handling of classified information. There's also Comey's letter to Congress in late October saying that he was reopening the probe, and then a second letter that he sent just days ahead of the election that saying that he was closing the investigation again. But another person who's likely to get criticized is probably Loretta Lynch, who was the attorney general at the time. She may be chastised for her oversight of the investigation. There's also Andrew McCabe, who was the deputy director of the FBI at the time, and a few other figures that have come up in the months in between. That would be Lisa Page and Peter Strzok. These are the two FBI officials whose text messages were discovered during the course of the Inspector General's investigation. These, of course, were texts that were highly critical of then-candidate Trump. And those are things, of course, that the president and his allies have used to fuel their accusations of political bias against the FBI.
Well, we're going to find out what's in this report in about an hour from now. Trump allies clearly eager for the details. Here's former Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz speaking on Fox News.
I think it will be devastating to the higher echelon of the FBI. I think they misused and abused their power. I think they were outside the normal protocols. Mr. Horowitz was unanimously confirmed by the United States Senate. He was appointed by President Obama. It should be widely accepted by anybody and everybody on both sides of the aisle as the closest that we're going to get to the truth.
And the Washington Post is reporting today that the report will reveal new text messages from an FBI agent to a DOJ lawyer in 2016 that said they will stop Trump from becoming president. How much could this report play into Trump's criticism of the Justice Department?
It was very likely to be used by the president as ammunition in his criticism on both the FBI and the Justice Department. And Trump actually signaled that he was looking forward to the report almost for that reason when he said last week that this would be a nice birthday present for him. Today, of course, is the president's birthday. So, yes, there's the accusations and the conclusions that we are likely to see from the Inspector General, who is indeed an independent actor in this, are most definitely going to be used by the president to further his narrative that the FBI and the Justice Department lack credibility, that they lack competence. And this furthers his narrative in his fight with those two institutions.
And the president gave the handling of the Clinton email situation as one of the reasons he fired FBI Director James Comey. Here's John Podesta responding to that. He was Clinton's former campaign chairman. He was speaking to The Hill.
Do you think there's anyone in America, whether they watch Fox News or MSNBC or watch Hill.com, who believes that Donald Trump fired Jim Comey because he was unfair to Hillary Clinton and kind of blew the election for us, which I think there's good evidence that he did?
Ryan, how much could this report feed Democrats' belief that Comey inappropriately swayed the outcome of the election?
Well, we're already actually hearing that from Democrats on the Hill. The early word from two of them who have seen the report, this is Congressman Jerry Nadler and Elijah Cummings, they say that their read on it is that the FBI's actions did indeed help Trump win. And they accuse Comey of a double standard. They say that, you know, he publicly revealed the Clinton investigation during the course of the campaign, but he didn't talk about, didn't reveal the FBI's investigation right. into possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia.
It's NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, there are new images today from the summit in Singapore. President Trump saluting a North Korean general, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, looking on, smiling broadly. The moment was captured for a 40-minute documentary that aired on North Korean state media after the summit. Then yesterday, in an interview with Fox News aboard Air Force One, Trump again heaped praise on the brutal North Korean dictator.
Hey, when you take over a country, tough country, with tough people, and you take it over from your father, I don't care who you are, what you are, how much of an advantage you have. If you can do that at 27 years old, that's one in 10,000 that could do that. So he's a very smart guy. He's a great negotiator. But I think we understand each other.
But he's still done some really bad things.
Yeah, but so have a lot of other people done some really bad things. I mean, I could go through a lot of nations where a lot of bad things were done. Now, look.
Let's take this up. Former Democratic Congresswoman Jane Harman now heads the Wilson Center. She's given this some thought. Congresswoman Harman, there's an active gulag in North Korea. American Otto Wambier died after being held there. Kim has had members of his own family murdered. His spending on nuclear weapons has starved his own people. Is it possible that President Trump doesn't mean the compliments he says about him, but is saying them for negotiating purposes?
Well, I hope that's why he's doing it. My answer to you is it is possible. I certainly commend him for making North Korea the first and primary focus of his foreign policy and for his unorthodox way of getting to a meeting. Diplomacy is better. Talking is better than bombing. But that meeting a few days ago was a made-for-television event, and I think in many ways it is going to be harder to fill in the details than it would have been had some more preparatory work occurred.
And because Kim was so elevated. Look, Marco Rubio, the senator, tweeted out after other compliments from Trump, while I know POTUS is trying to butter him up to get a good deal, he agrees with that theory, Kim is not a talented guy. He inherited the family business from his dad and grandfather. He's a total weirdo who would not be elected assistant dog catcher in any democracy. Now, oddly, critics of Donald Trump might say that that might be Freudian on Rubio's part because Trump himself inherited his business from his father. But how are Trump's compliments of Kim heard around the world?
I think there's a very mixed reaction. I mean, Trump is obviously impressed by strong men, and they all seem to be men, who engage in activities that are pretty anti-democratic in their countries. He's more impressed by them than by, let's say, obviously, the leaders of major countries in Europe or Justin Trudeau in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think to amplify my comment before, I think if our goal is this acronym that I'm just memorizing, CVID, Complete Verifiable Irreversible Denuclearization, some of these comments will make that harder. I mean, Kim already has the PR victory here. He's standing and sitting with the U.S. president. He's put out his own version of a propaganda movie for North Korean consumption. He's meeting with the leaders of the major countries of the world. I think we're going to see that some of those countries, including China and possibly others, start more trade with North Korea, banking on the fact that the U.S. Won't come out after them for that, since we need their support for the deal we're trying to make with North Korea. So Kim has got more economic help, equal stature, as he sees it in the world, with the United States, and hasn't had to do anything yet.
Look, some would say Presidents Obama, Bush, and Clinton all prioritized North Korea's nuclear threat over addressing human rights issues, so they don't see this as a problem with Trump. But he's not just overlooking the human rights issues. He's heaping these compliments and saluting a general, that picture that we mentioned. Look, I went on military chat sites. We know that American presidents only started saluting their own military when Reagan did. But many soldiers there said, you don't salute three countries' military, Iran, North Korea, and Syria. Just your thoughts in the minute we have on what that image means.
Well, that image is disturbing, and I don't think enough preparation was made. Maybe no one anticipated that that could happen. I think Trump's gesture is unfortunate. But let's go back to what really matters here. What matters here is follow-on work that achieves a complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of the country, or at least a freeze for freeze. That's made harder by some of the statements of Trump and the fact that he backed out of the Iran deal, which sets a floor that he may not be able to exceed here.
Former Democratic Congresswoman Jane Harman of the Wilson Center Now. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
A bipartisan bill that would allow states to pass their own marijuana laws without interference from the federal government is gaining momentum in Congress. It's an issue because the Department of Justice, under Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has returned to prosecuting marijuana as a banned substance, even though recreational cannabis is legal in 10 states and most states allow it for medical use. President Trump has signaled he'd sign the bill. The States Act, as it's called, was filed last week by Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts, where recreational pot sales become legal on July 1st, and Senator Cory Gardner, Republican from Colorado, which in 2012 became the first state to legalize recreational marijuana. They join us from the Capitol. Senators, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And let me first ask what exactly this bill would do. Senator Warren, let me start with you.
This is a bill that says when the states have passed different laws about marijuana, maybe it's about medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, it will conflict with the federal law on marijuana because nothing has been changed. And this bill says the federal government will treat the state's law as the law of that state. In other words, no interference. So when Massachusetts laws go into effect, then the federal government will recede and Massachusetts will be the one in control of its destiny on marijuana. Same thing for Colorado, same thing for any other state.
Senator Gardner, is there any law that's like this that is on the books somewhere else on some other issue where the states disagree with the federal government? I mean, did you look to something that's happened in the past?
Well, you know, you've got a lot of ideas in law where the state's given some ideas of where they can lead. You know, highway bills where the funding comes from the federal government and the highway bill gets spent, the money gets spent by the state. Or perhaps there's speed limit restrictions, those kinds of things. But I really can't think of anything else.
Yeah. And look, it's basically a way to try to deal with a law that's just antiquated. The federal law is an absolute prohibition. It treats marijuana as a Schedule I drug, which is the same as heroin and cocaine, and says it has no research use, it has no medical use, which, frankly, we'd like to be able to do more research around it. And we have a lot of evidence starting to grow that there are medical uses for marijuana. And besides, folks in Massachusetts, just like folks in Colorado, got together and said, here's how we want to treat marijuana in Massachusetts. And now that that's the case, we think the federal government just ought to back off.
Why not just change the federal law then and legalize marijuana at the federal level?
Well, I think you could certainly do that. In fact, there have been legislative attempts to do just that, and they've gone nowhere. But if you look at the Constitution, whether it's the 10th Amendment or the Interstate Commerce Clause talks about goods of an intrastate nature being regulated by the state. And so this is something that I think our founders said there may be disagreement. So let's let states do what they want to. It's also a way for us to politically thread a needle with a couple of tricky issues that we haven't been able to find so far. Number one, there are states that aren't going to want to do this. Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska. I think they've even sued Colorado over some of the marijuana industry's impact that they felt that they could see in their states. The other thing that it addresses, of course, is the banking issue. Right now, if you're a business, you're a landlord and you receive rent from a marijuana business, if you're a worker who gets paid by one of these industries, you can't take it to the bank. And so this fixes the financial services issue with the banking prohibitions. And the third thing it fixes, of course, is this issue of taxation. Many of these businesses, medical businesses and others, are paying 90% tax rates, effective rates, because they can't take a standard business deduction like any other business would. So this fixes in a very elegant, simple fashion those questions through a federalism approach.
I want to listen here to the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who last week was asked about your bill in an interview with Colorado Public Radio.
At this time, my view is clear that the federal law remains in effect nationwide, just like it does for heroin or cocaine. And that, of course, it's not the death-dealing drug in the same way that fentanyl or heroin is, but it remains on the books as a prohibited substance.
If your bill cannot get the support it needs, do you think there's any chance of convincing Jeff Sessions to do what you want him to do, essentially, without having a law in place to say that?
Look, I don't think we're going to change Jeff Sessions' mind. I think that's what he was saying on Colorado radio. You know, I'm not changing my mind. Okay, we get that. But the problem is, even if you could back off the attorney general and get the attorney general to stay out of Massachusetts as we start to put our new marijuana laws in place, the problem is there are other difficulties in law. So as Senator Gardner identified, for example, a marijuana business can't put its cash into an FDIC-insured bank because that cash, from a federal law perspective, appears to come from an illegal source.
Right.
And so that's why we need our bill, whether Jeff Sessions is attorney general or somebody else is attorney general.
Senator Gardner, it may be surprising to some people that you are supporting this, given that you didn't support legalization in Colorado back in 2012.
That's right. I didn't support legalization. The people of Colorado spoke very clearly. I think if they spoke again, they'd speak with an even stronger voice in support of legalization. This is a challenge now that has a $2 billion cash flow in Colorado. It's a challenge that Senator Warren just identified, where you have money. This money is not going into banks. It's just floating around. I don't know if it's in backpacks, if in warehouses, what they're doing with it.
U-Haul trucks.
U-Haul trucks, right. But we have, I mean, it's, so you have this public hypocrisy problem, too, along with that public safety issue of $2 billion in cash floating around. But you have this hypocrisy in that the state can collect a tax on it. The city can collect a tax on it. Somehow it's okay for them to put it into a bank, but the person who works in the industry can't even get a home loan. So we have it now. It's here. It's not going away. And how do we allow the state then to do what it believes is best?
Back in October of 2016, I spoke with the governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, who's a Democrat who opposed the legalization as well. And I asked him how it was working out and whether he thinks other states should follow Colorado. Here's what he said.
I think the jury's still out. And when other governors ask me, I tell them they should wait a couple of years.
Senator Warren, as we prepare to see legalization in Massachusetts, what are your concerns? Are you worried about anything that might happen as a result of legalizing recreational marijuana, teen use, driving under the influence, et cetera?
Of course. And I'm particularly worried about the fact that we're not doing enough research. What constitutes driving under the influence? We need actual research on that. Right now, that's a real problem because so long as the federal government continues to schedule marijuana as a Schedule I drug, it is extraordinarily difficult to be able to do any kind of study around it.
And I've actually agreed with this, the same sentiment that Governor Hickenlooper laid out in that comment. I've said to people, hey, why don't you just wait and see what happens in Colorado? Maybe in 5 years, it'll be the best thing we've ever done. Maybe in 5 years, they'll do something different. But, you know, they've seen some of the regulations that have been put in place. They've seen the effects, and a lot of states aren't waiting. They're moving forward. So we can't really wait. Getting more information, getting us from the anecdotal tidbits to actual science research is going to be an important part of this debate.
And I would just add on that, because I am particularly worried about the impact on children, on developing brains. The small amount of research that I've seen on this suggests that the impact of the active drug in marijuana on developing brains is very different from the impact on adult brains. And that's something we're going to need to take account of in Massachusetts and in other states that are legalizing the drug for recreational uses to be particularly vigilant, both in enforcing laws about age restrictions, but also in doing the outreach and education programs to make sure that those who are most vulnerable stay away from it.
Finally, I want to ask each of you a question about something else. And Senator Gardner, let me start with you. Your Republican colleague, Bob Corker, of Tennessee, says Republicans are cult-like in their reluctance to cross President Trump. I just wonder whether you agree with that.
Well, look, I think there's been a lot of very public moments where I have broken with the president. We'll continue to where I disagree with him. We'll continue to work with him where I do agree with him. But as recently as today, talked about my hope that we could continue major exercises in South Korea as we work toward a denuclearized North Korea. But I think Senator Corker obviously is frustrated over a number of things, including legislation that I believe is important, and that's rolling back the tariffs that are affecting our trade and our trade allies. So I think there's a level of frustration over trade policies that is reflected in Senator Corker's statements. But, I hope that everybody will express their dissatisfaction and their disagreements as publicly as they always have, including those times where they can work together.
You think they're doing that enough, your colleagues?
That's up to them. I don't speak for them. I speak for myself. And I've made it very clear where we've had moments of disagreement and moments of agreement.
Senator Warren, there was an article in the New York Times the other day, I'm sure you saw it, about Democrats spending a lot of time in New York raising money, including you. When are you going to make a decision about whether you're going to run for president?
I am not running for president. I'm running for Senate in Massachusetts 2018. Woohoo! November 6th.
I was hoping we could get an announcement right
here.
I was really excited. This would make news, a lot of it.
Come on, guys. I am not running for president. I'm running for Senate in Massachusetts, and I'm in a whole bunch of fights right here in the Senate right now. Senator Gardner and I are working hard to get this bill through. I have a bill on opioid treatment. We've got a bill on the floor that we're wrestling around with that will expand the president's ability to build nuclear weapons without having to come back to Congress for direct approval. I'm fighting hard against that. So there are a lot of issues that we are right in the heart of.
Senators, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren and Republican Senator Cory Gardner.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
There will be a total of 4 interest rate hikes this year. That news from the Federal Reserve, which raised its benchmark rate a quarter of a percentage point yesterday to 2%. Here's Fed Chair Jerome Powell.
The main takeaway is that the economy is doing very well. Most people who want to find jobs are finding them, and unemployment and inflation are low.
Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the chair, Jerome Powell, also said the economy is in great shape, which is kind of unusual language for a Fed chair.
It is, yeah, very much an optimistic presentation from him yesterday. And they basically signaled that they're going to probably raise interest rates another 2 times this year after raising the federal funds rate to a top range of 2% yesterday. So basically the economy is doing well enough that they believe it can withstand a gradual increase in interest rates.
And that means 4 rate hikes total this year. In March, they said there would only be 3.
Right. So the getting a little bit more aggressive with the rate hikes. And obviously, you know, it's important to understand the thinking for why they do this. They don't want the economy to get sort of too hot. Unemployment rate is very low right now. And the inflation rate is starting to move up. It's right near their sort of target at 2%. And so by moving interest rates up, the thinking is that inflation won't get out of control and the job market won't get so hot that it sort of feeds into the inflation.
What about the housing market? I looked and the average 30-year fixed rate mortgage yesterday was 4.76%. That's up from 4.7% last week, up from 4.66% in May. So mortgage rates slowly climbing. What does this rate hike mean, or these continued rate hikes? What are they going to mean for the housing market?
Well, you know, it's important to sort of understand what exactly this rate is that the Fed's talking about. The Fed funds rate is the interest rate that banks charge each other for a quick loan that a bank might need to maintain its required reserves. But it has a very profound influence on interest rates throughout the economy. So, interest rates are creeping higher at about, like you said, 4.5% to 4.75%. So far, the housing market seems like it's doing fine, even though these rates are creeping higher. There is still enough demand to keep the housing market afloat.
And what about other kinds of borrowing, car loans, credit cards, et cetera?
Yeah, so they all tend to be influenced by this federal funds rate, not necessarily after the rate is lifted. A lot of times the credit markets realize this is coming and they adjust along the way. But over the course of time, obviously, when the Fed is on a tightening cycle like it is now where it's raising rates, the rest of the interest rates across the economy will tend to follow it on the way up.
And we're talking about a 2% federal funds rate. Now, we should remember that before the financial crisis, it was around 5%, and in the early 80s, it was at 19%.
Right. So it's now back to where it was in 2008 when it was on its way down to about zero. But you're right, 2007, it was over 5%. So still very what the Fed would probably call accommodative to the financial system. It's very stimulative to have rates this low to help companies get the money they need to expand.
Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The Supreme Court gave conservatives two victories today. In the first decision, the court struck down the so-called Minnesota voter clothing law, which banned voters from wearing political apparel to polling stations. And in the second, the court sided with the Trump administration in an antitrust case against China. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. And Domenico, the clothing case, it started in 2010. Minnesota officials said that Tea Party T-shirts that said, "Please ID me," violated that state's law because they were supporting laws favored by Republicans requiring photo IDs at polling stations. Remind us a little more about that Minnesota law.
Well, this was the biggest case today. Mm-hmm. We were expecting possibly more, and we were expecting that this case could be written more broadly. But instead, what the Supreme Court did here in a 7-2 decision, it wrote an extremely narrowly focused opinion. It struck down Minnesota's law that bars voters inside a polling place from wearing, any kinds of political paraphernalia, whether it's a, please ID me badge, as this man had on inside his polling place, a Tea Party shirt, vote for Hillary shirt, or whatever it is. You're not allowed to do that inside of the polling place based on the Minnesota law. But instead of writing a broad decision that could have applied to other states and other places, the court instead wrote something very narrow that said that the Minnesota law itself was far too broad, that almost anything could have been seen as political. So if you wore a Ben and Jerry's T-shirt because Ben Cohen has been involved in politics, or if you wore an AARP T-shirt because they engage in issue and political activities, then you'd be in violation of the state law. So what the court decided to do was say that this particular law is a problem. But if you think that you're going to challenge, for example, where people thought this was going was that they would challenge the buffer zone law. So in other words, way back a long time ago, voting used to be a pretty precarious situation. People in the 1800s would go up to you and basically lord over you to make sure that you voted a certain way. They said no. Yeah. Those laws barring people from those kinds of things are perfectly constitutional. It was just the way Minnesota's law was written.
In the seconds we have left, I'm just going to mention the court also sided against China in an antitrust case. They threw out a lower court ruling that two Chinese vitamin C makers didn't have to pay a huge fine. They do, nearly $150 million. That case was brought by two American vitamin makers accusing the Chinese of antitrust violations. Mm-hmm. So we will take a closer look at that at another time. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
And out of Florida, where David Howard of Tampa, Florida, is going to spend 8 months in prison and then serve 2 years probation for shouting racial slurs and violent threats at a Muslim couple about to buy the home next door. And this week, the judge also ordered Howard to pay $30,000 in restitution to Kaidarbai Ali Asghar and his family. It's the down payment they lost back in 2016 when they backed out of buying the home because of those threats. This was supposed to be the last walkthrough. Ali, his wife, her elderly parents, the realtors, sellers, the movers were all there. The house, a dream home in an upscale area. When suddenly David Howard burst out of his home, yelling vile threats, most we can't fully repeat. Kaidarbai Ali Asghar joins us now from WUSF in Tampa. This must have been horrible.
To us, to me, my family, and my in-laws, that was the shock of our life, basically. And we even could not even think or contemplate what is going on. So right. when things went to that point, we thought, okay, this is not the time we should be there. So we immediately moved out.
I'm sure it felt so dangerous to you. Look, he said, I will break all your F-bomb windows and I will burn your F-bomb house down if these people move in here. He said to the movers, are you really going to move in these dot heads? You know, a slur. It was vile and shocking and frightening, I'm imagining.
Yes, yeah. Shocking, frightening. I would say I'll go one more step. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Because you cannot even think that this somebody in that area could even think of, forget about speaking and confronting like this.
Yeah. Has this ever happened to you before, being targeted for being a Muslim or being, you know?
Thank God. It never happened. In fact, this country is so great, you know. People are good. Honestly, this was the first time and was so severe that it shook us from our core, you know.
Yeah. Well, and you decide to back out of the purchase even though you lost $30,000.
Yes.
Look, what did you think when you found out that there is such a thing as the Fair Housing Law? It's a civil rights law. It prevents housing discrimination based on race or religion. And under this law, you cannot prevent someone from buying a home, which in effect those threats did.
What we wanted to do was to look at our Justice Department and the FBI to get us to the point where we feel that we are safe and the justice is done. And this whole journey was a lot of trials and tribulations, pain and, you know, sweating. But at the end, what we saw is justice was done.
Well, look, we know that David Howard's defense was that he lost a family member in 9/11. He wasn't crazy about Muslims. He says this in a deposition. He also told the judge, I have a terminal illness. I'm dying of AIDS. His lawyers blamed his outburst on testosterone supplements that he was taking because of the AIDS. Did that change your thinking at all, maybe become more sympathetic?
When he narrated his own challenges in the court, of course, as a human, you, me, or anybody, even a stone-hearted person would melt, you know. So owning the responsibility without blaming the external factor was what we feel is more important, and that gives a sense of a natural human being having a kind heart.
Well, he did say to the judge that he acted wrongly. The incident happened and he wished he could undo it. But the judge also reminded him that he said in the testimony for the civil suit that's still pending that if he had done the same thing in New York that he did to you in Tampa, he would have gotten a ticker tape parade. And he also said he lost a family member in 9/11 and he wasn't crazy about Muslims. So that seems to cancel out some of his feelings. But meanwhile, where are you and your family going to maybe try to now move to Davis Islands?
After all this, what has happened now, probably we are now trying to first bring ourselves back together to the point that we start trusting people. You know, we do trust, but there's like a space there where we still feel when you go to an unknown place, hey, how people will react because the way we put our attire. Though it's a nice attire. If you see, you'll fall in love with that. It's not like something, you know. And people also, at times, they don't understand or they even don't think. My small action, more than the, close to 2 years, we are working, fighting on this. So how many man hours, how much pain, play, all that has gone into this.
Yeah. And as you said, you still have a place in your heart, it sounds like, where you and your family aren't sure.
Oh, yeah, because it's very hard to contemplate how it affects me and my, especially my kids. When this type of incidents happens, you and I can take it, but with the kids, it's very hard to recover. It takes time.
That's Kadubai Ali Askar, and we wish you the best of luck wherever your new home is. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And before I leave, I have to share one. Like, we have an old proverb, and my mom from our childhood, she used to always tell us that. So when there's a righteousness in the heart, there's a beauty in the character. When there's beauty in the character, there is harmony in home. And when there is harmony in the home itself, there's order in life. And when there's order in life, it enlightens everyone and brings peace, security, and respect for all.
Well, Kadubai Ali Askar, we wish you all the best in wherever your home is. Thank you. Thank you so much.
The debate over gun violence in the U.S. often focuses on the epidemic of mass shootings at schools and other public places. But most gun deaths in this country are suicides. Suicide rates are rising in nearly every state, according to the CDC, and New Hampshire is near the top of the list. An unlikely team of gun owners and public health experts in that state have come together to launch a prevention campaign called the Gun Shop Project. New Hampshire Public Radio's Lauren Chulgin reports.
When Ralph D'Amico talks about the origins of the Gunshop Project, he mentions two phone calls. They both came from Elaine Frank, then a public health expert at Dartmouth. The first call was about 20 years ago, back when D'Amico owned a gun shop in Hooksett, New Hampshire.
You know, not to stereotype, but generally people from the medical community and people from the firearms community don't share a lot of common ground. And I said, hi.
Frank was calling to see if D'Amico would be part of a local group to promote gun safety. He was skeptical at first, but decided to join. The second call came a few years later, and it was a tough one.
You know, it's one of those calls where it's like, ooh, I don't really know if I want to do this.
Frank had some bad news. There were three suicides within the same week, and each person had purchased a gun from D'Amico's shop. D'Amico was stunned. He hadn't heard anything about it.
Living with the idea that one of your customers has taken his or her life is not a light burden. It's very uncomfortable.
So together, D'Amico and Frank went back to their gun safety group and decided to only focus their attention on gun suicides. Frank knew that suicides made up most of the gun deaths in New Hampshire and that guns are used in most suicide deaths across the country.
And it's not because firearm owners are more likely to be depressed or have mental illness or even more likely to attempt suicide. But a suicide attempt with a firearm is far more likely to be lethal than by almost any other means.
So they decided gun shops would be the best place to start, hence the name the Gun Shop Project. They traveled to gun stores all over New Hampshire, handing out posters and cards that describe signs of suicidal behavior. And they talked to employees about how to avoid selling a firearm to someone who could be suicidal. Some shop owners were still skeptical. D'Amico says many of them felt like it was a trick, another way to blame guns for violence.
I had one gun shop call me and he said, hey, what's going on here? And I told him, he said, so you think this is innocuous? I said, absolutely, it's fine. I said, Trust me, I know the demons when I see them. This is not one of them.
In the end, about half of New Hampshire gun shops hung up the prevention posters, and the coalition called it a success. Their work has inspired states all over the country to create their own versions of the Gun Shop Project. But this all started 10 years ago, before Sandy Hook, before Parkland, before Santa Fe. And that skepticism from gun owners has grown as division over gun issues has widened. And that skepticism has been front of mind lately as the Gun Shop Project tries a new approach this summer. They want New Hampshire firearms instructors to show a video about suicide prevention in their classes.
Welcome to my classroom. Have a seat.
Thomas Brown has been a firearms instructor for over two decades, and most of his time has been spent here at the Manchester Firing Line Indoor Range. Brown joined the coalition a few years ago, and he's been helping craft the language of this video in a way that he says could help win over people who are pro-gun.
We as gun owners are constantly under attack, and one of the things that is constantly thrown in our face is the number of gun deaths. And when you realize that two-thirds roughly are suicides, that if we could reduce that number, wouldn't that be good for us?
The point of this video is to educate about the signs of suicide and to encourage those watching to hold on to a friend or family member's gun if it seems like they're having a hard time.
Sometimes getting involved at a critical point during someone's despair may make the difference.
But among the dramatic music and public health pointers is language like this that helps get Brown's argument across.
Suicide deaths are terrible for everyone involved. Firearm suicides also hurt the cause of liberty when the numbers are used to justify more gun laws. Let's work together to reduce all suicides, especially the ones where a firearm may be used.
Brown has tested out the video in a few of his classes, and he says it's already increased awareness.
Most people just nod their head and say, yeah, well, that makes sense, or they hadn't even crossed their mind about firearms and suicide.
This is the reaction Elaine Frank and Ralph D'Amico were hoping for with this new project. D'Amico says they could make an even bigger impact with firearm safety classes because people are already there ready to learn about guns, and the message is coming from a trusted voice.
Firearms instructors, they reach a tremendous amount of people, all new shooters. What better way to make people aware than to take a new shooter and, if I can use that terrible term, indoctrinate them into thinking positively about suicide prevention?
Doesn't mean you have to give up your view on guns or on public health or on overreaching government or whatever. You can keep doing all those things, but in the meetings, you focus on what you have in common.
And the Gun Shop Project's Elaine Frank says this consensus building among people with opposing views, that's something the country seems to have lost, that she thinks would be a really good thing to bring back. For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Schulgen.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.